Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is February 16th, 2019, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400 with anything about finances or investments or the economy or things of that ilk. Please do not call about sports.
Well, if you do, just expect a really, really ignorant answer, because we're not very informed in the world of sports.
There are some interesting things went on in the economy that may or may not be significant. Now, that's a strange statement, but that's really the way it is. The Commerce Department, and this was a big thing on Thursday, released a report saying that consumer spending from November to December dropped 1.2%. Now, that's a seasonally adjusted 1.2%. And, you know, the scary thing is that is the biggest drop in consumer spending in 1 month since...
No, it's retail consumer spending.
Right, retail.
Which is pretty important for December.
Which, it's the biggest drop since 2009. And 2009 obviously causes everybody to kind of shudder and think, "Oh no, not that again." The September 2009 we had a drop a little bigger than 1.3%, but that meant that things are really falling apart at that point. Retail sales increase over the last decade have been pretty steady at about 0.4, 0.2, 0.5. They've averaged 0.4% a month. So we've had consumers spending more and more and more and more and being very consistent about it over a period of time. And then suddenly in December, we have this big drop in consumer spending. Now, that if that wasn't bad enough, the online sales. Now, this is where the biggest growth in consumer spending has been. Consumer spending, retail spending has been online. It dropped 3.9% in December. Now, December, this is Christmas we're talking about. A 3.9% drop in consumer spending, and about 70% of the United States economy is consumer.
Now this is why you were vague about it at the beginning. This may or may not be important. Because in the middle of December, at the end of December, actually, this is after the day of Christmas is when this, the day before Christmas Eve, it came out. MasterCard said that consumer spending, excluding automobiles, rose 5.1%.
Mm-hmm.
So the numbers that you're talking about are excluding gasoline, but not automobiles. What this is showing is that there's a very clear area. Online sales are down. Automobile sales are down.
And we have a record number of people who are more than 90 days overdue on their automobile loan payments.
So all of those are signs of an economy that was ramped up, hyped up with kind of a steroid injection. And a lot of people spent a lot of money because they heard tax cut. And they thought that meant that their tax return was going to be a large amount of money. This is the problem, and this is kind of scary. I don't want to give sound bites out there for opposition parties and so on to use, but expect the news about tax returns to be negative, because we had this big tax cut, and a lot of people thought this means I'm going to get a really big refund this year. And what's happened is the withholding was changed, and you've gotten little bits of that tax cut throughout the year. Which means that you may get a significantly smaller tax refund this year than you're expecting.
And it may be smaller than last year's.
It may be smaller than last year's because people's withholding rates were dropped down so low that they received part of their payment throughout the year in their paychecks. So just as this is fodder for the Democrats. They're going to grab onto this and say, look, it's failing and so on. The reality of this is going back to, if we can get down to the micro level rather than the macro for a minute, when you're looking at your own budget, figure out how much you're paying for taxes. It's a real number. Figure out how much you paid last year. And if you're waiting for a big refund, That's a really, really bad financial decision to run your life based on a big refund check, because in essence, what you're doing there is you're giving a interest-free loan, an interest-free deposit to the federal government so that it can return it to you in a large chunk in sometime in the early part of the next year. Instead, look at what you're paying in taxes, talk to your tax preparer, figure out what your actual number should be, and then take a little bit of money and put it aside in a savings account or something like that. Then you won't be disappointed at some point when the voodoo, which is what is the tax preparation these days, it's you've got to dance three times clockwise around a moonstruck pine tree while standing on one foot with your pinky up your nose to figure out if you're doing your taxes right, because the taxes are just way too complicated. Instead, go to the thing that you do know. And this whole thing with the car purchase being down, right now is peak car buying season, and they're not seeing the peak car buying because so far the refunds have been lower than what was expected by the tax folks.
And they're not coming out as fast as they should because of the shutdown.
We had a government shutdown. So all of that adds up to mean there are more complications out there, and it's really easy to go with the shallowest and simplest explanation. Hey, I got a smaller refund this year. That means the tax cut wasn't real. That's not true. The tax cut was real. You just have to figure out how your taxes are getting paid. And the reality is that taxes are so complex that the average person or the average very educated person has no idea what the amount that they should be paying in taxes is throughout the year.
Well, actually, there's a irony in this tax law and at this time on that very subject you just mentioned. Since so many people that previously itemized are now falling under standard deduction.
Right.
We can, for the first time,
have a really good idea what you need to pay.
Right. And the point is that as a result of that, if automatic withholding was done based on what you put on your, what is it? Is it W-9?
W-2.
No, the
W-9.
W-9. If you put that on there and you fall into the large majority of taxpayers who are strictly under standard deduction, you're going to get an act. You were charged during the year 2018 with almost the perfect number on taxes, which means that you may not get any refund at all. You may get a very tiny refund. The survey of refunds from the IRS, and they're running way behind on getting the refunds out when people send in tax returns, by the way.
W-9 is the proof of Social Security.
Well, it's the W something.
Yeah.
Where you say how many dependents you have and so on. When you fill that form out for your employer, presuming that they have that and it's accurate, you're probably going to get closer to
W-4.
The W-4. That's
man,
it.
Why can you not even remember
can't
which
remember the forms.
Number letter combinations?
The point is that you may get a very tiny tax return this year. That's what the
refund.
Survey, a tax refund this year that may be very tiny because that's the way the system is set up so you don't overpay during the year. And that's going to be a bit of a shock if you've been overpaying in the past and you were itemizing and you don't get to itemize anymore because you won't know until you do your taxes. And the IRS is running behind getting the tax returns processed. But there's an ongoing – the other thing I wanted to throw in the same time – on the same day that was Thursday, the Commerce Department came out and said that the revised down industrial production in the United States to a 0.1% gain for December, and then for January, industrial production in the United States fell 0.6%. Now, it would have fallen a lot more, except the unusually cold weather caused utility production to go up, which is industrial production. Now, this is the thing about this. We don't know why we had this sudden drop, but there's a suspicion that the market drop scared people, the market drop, the government shutdown, the threat
trade
of
war.
Tariffs, all of those things together scared consumers and manufacturers enough that they hit the pause button. If that's true, then this is just going to be a blip. It'll go by, and it means nothing. If, in fact, we see January, February turn into declines across the board, then we got something to worry about.
And this kind of fits into that. In December, exports from China dropped 4.4%. That's a recession, a move backwards, not like a full-on recession. It receded from its point from before. Then in January, it surged 9% upward. We know why that was. We know why exports went up so high in January, because they're afraid of the tariffs. This is the same thing that happened here before the tariffs were instigated with the huge chunk of the world. We went into full-on export mode, and we had these big spikes in export and then a drop after the tariffs. It's happening in China. So if you put all of this together, what you're going to get is a lot of confusion, where a lot of business people, both Chinese, American, Canadian, basically business people all over the world, Japan, Germany, are trying to make decisions with not enough information. There is no certainty. So the purchase decisions and the manufacturing decisions are generally well thought out, but we don't have enough information to make the decision. So we're going to have start, stop, big spikes in exports, big drops in exports, with big jumps in spending, big drops in spending, based on people just looking around going, what's going on again? What's going on? And if we could get some clarity there, just some clarity on what's going on in the trade war, some clarity on how long is the government going to be open? What is this concept of a state of emergency? Is it going to be fought in courts? What are the ramifications of that? All of that comes out to say, in 10 years, it's likely that we'll look back at this and not even remember all the minutiae. We'll just look back and say, man, that was a confusing time. But right now, people are in panic mode, and they're right on the edge of it. We had a panic, a real panic in the market in December. We haven't had one of those since the beginning of the Great Recession. The way you can tell a real panic is when everything goes down. We talked about this as it was going on. Everything went down. Profitable things went down. Unprofitable things went down. And then since then, we've seen it all come back up, including unprofitable things. That means that we're not taking this panic moment that happened in December to do a real look at why we are where we are in our investments. If you're in that mode, you've just watched it go up and down, you're not really sure why you're in the investments that you're in, talk to the person that recommended those investments to you, and if they're not sure either, you need a fiduciary. I tend to think you need a fiduciary, period. You need somebody that's working on your best interests, not flat out just working. Find somebody that's working in your best interest and has a real plan on why it is that they are where they are. This uncertainty happens. We're talking about it like it's completely new, because parts of it are. We haven't been in a trade war in a long time, but that doesn't make it new. We haven't had national emergencies declared over not much in a long time, but that doesn't make it new. It's happened. It was just a long time ago. We can look at history and figure out what happens. That Theodore Roosevelt sent the military to Tripoli in a fleet without congressional funding. They only had enough money to feed the troops in the fleet halfway across the Atlantic. And that was brinksmanship on a whole different level. It wasn't furloughed. It was maybe our entire fleet will starve on the way across. So we've done this before. It's just we have to stretch back a long ways to figure out what ramifications really mean to this sort of stuff. The reality is long-term planning is the only way to get through this. You cannot try to tactically solve your investment problems when the tactical situation is completely unknown. You got to go to strategy again. You got to say, all right, tactics are important, but let's consolidate, make sure our reserves are in place. We've got to go back to the fundamentals. Maintain your reserves in your savings account. Don't get a lot of debt right now, because this is boom time still. We're still in good shape. But man, things are, all of the hallmarks are out there to say we've got a slowdown coming.
And while you're at it, don't compound your problems. There's several articles Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, that I've seen gradually popping up. Now, they're about the fourth tier down. You have to really dig down in finance or economy to find these articles. But they're all in agreement on a point, and that is that leveraged high-yield loans are extremely dangerous. They are like collateralized mortgage obligations in 2006 at this point. They're becoming more and more popular. Basically, if you're in a bond fund or an ETF, or maybe, I doubt that anybody who's listening to this program has actually gone out and bought individual leveraged bonds, but they sound really good, and this is the point. They pay high interest rates, and the people who sell them make nice noises about how they're guaranteed by this, that, or collateralized by this thing or that thing over there, and there's no way they can lose.
Yeah, anytime somebody says that, you need to go, what? Wait a minute.
And there's some evidence that insurance companies are buying them up as well. Not a lot of them, but some. The point is that the collateralized are what's called high-yield leverage loans, basically is borrowing money to buy high-yield bonds. And, yeah, you can rack up some really, really high interest rates and get some really, really high yields. And it looks really, really impressive with some bond. You buy a bond fund or something and they have a dividend, a high dividend rate, 6, 8, 9%. And we've actually had some people contact us about that, about how wonderful it was, and they wanted to have some of that. And we said no. That is extremely unrealistic. Anytime that you get above the 3%, just under 3%, 2.8, 2.9%, that the 30-year U.S. bonds are paying right now, you start to take on risk. You get up to two times that number or three times that number, you're taking some really phenomenal risk. You just don't know it. And the reason you don't know it is we have gone now almost 10 years without a downturn in the market, without a cleaning out, a bear market and a recession to clean out the junk and the system, the deadwood. But the deadwood is there, and the deadwood is borrowing money to cover its losses, and it is selling high yield, which we used to call junk bonds, in the form of ETFs, in the form of mutual funds, and in a lot of other places to the public.
Now, on that same concept, it's going to sound like a subject shift. It isn't. You're going to have to take this as another piece of the same puzzle. Job switchers in January saw the best wage gain since 2007.
Yeah, that was significant.
That's a 4.6% jump in wages by switching jobs. That's significant. Why am I saying that right after you were talking about what you're talking about?
It's the same thing.
Because when the economy is pushing the edges of the envelope, getting tired but still trying to push forward, wage growth and competition for employees is one of the things that puts an extra strain on businesses. So take advantage of it if you can, but also recognize this is one of the signs of a maturing boom in an economy. By maturing, it means there's only so much more of this that can keep coming. If you just got a big wage increase because you switched jobs, great job. Now make yourself extra important at your new job. Make yourself so fundamentally important there that they cannot imagine doing the job without you. Because if we have a downturn, who's the first people that get laid off?
The last people hired, the people who are most expensive.
You just came in as the most expensive new hires in a decade, and you better earn it. So don't go in there thinking this is your due. Congratulations, you got this offer, but earn it, because otherwise you're going to be cut if we have a downturn. And when you get this going on, this is what leads to the downturn.
This is, the British have a term for this.
Oh, what's that?
Job redundancy.
Oh, yes. You've become redundant.
Your position has become a redundancy. Bye.
And then they sack you. And then they redundant sacking.
Yes, it's redundant. It's redundancy sacking.
So that is the best probably generalized educational statement I can give to anybody out there right now is if you just switch job to get a better pay, and you want to keep that job, really put your best foot forward. Get in there and don't take it for granted. They may have just recruited you where they treated you like you were the most amazing person on the planet. Now you got to be that person, because otherwise you got a target on your head if we have a downturn.
There's another thing that's coming, that we have an anniversary, a 10-year anniversary or something that just came up this last week. Did you know that?
A 10-year anniversary
of a major financial event in Texas.
Of 10 years ago.
In Texas.
In Texas?
Yes.
Let's see, that would have been...
Stanford.
2000. Oh, yeah, Stanford, the Ponzi schemer in Houston. Yeah.
You know, the funny thing was, because he came fairly quickly after Madoff, who holds the record right now. Number two doesn't get much history, and you may not even remember Stanford. Isn't that a university or something?
Well, he used their trademarked crest, and that was one of the first lawsuits against him was Stanford University said, you can't use our crest, even if it is your last name. This is our crest.
But the thing is about the Stanford scam is he set up overseas banks in Antigua and several other places, including Venezuela. And he was offering CDs in the United States to people with significantly higher rates than CDs at regular FDIC-insured banks. And his salespeople assured people that they were perfectly safe.
Oh, yeah.
They were backed by the bank.
Had some of his salespeople talk to me and give me materials that had FDIC on them. And I said, how can this be right? This can't be right. And I didn't hear back from them after I asked those questions.
And the point is, this is much of the money, not all, but certainly about 60% of the money that Madoff made off with.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. He didn't really made off with. He just paid to other investors. He really wasn't skimming that big a piece. As a result, somewhere between 60 and 80% of that money will probably eventually totally be recovered and returned to the people, so that their loss on principal, admittedly with a 10-year period of time, they didn't get to do anything with the money. The loss on principal for the Madoff investors is probably going to be between 60 and 80, 60, the, I mean, it's, what anyway, 20 to 40%.
I'm just looking at this, the MadoffTrustee.com says that they now have recovered more than 75% of the estimated $17.5
billion. 60 to 80%, like I said, so depending on who you are and how much they took back from you and how much they give to you. This is the irony. In the Stanford loss, they haven't recovered more than just a few percent. And the law firm that's acting as the trustee trying to recover this money has now, I think they've recovered out of the 6 to 8 billion, that's 6 to 8 thousand million dollars. They have recovered about $600 million, but the law firm has charged
Stanford.
For Stanford. They've charged the fund $224 million to do that. So they're really netting less than $4 million, $400 million returned out of somewhere between $6 and $8 thousand million, which means that the people, and by the way, they haven't returned any money yet to the investors. The people who bought these CDs from Stanford basically are getting back next to nothing. Even though it's been 10 years, they still haven't got their money back, and they're probably not going to get much of anything back. Now, what has that got to do? Why am I saying this? That was old news 10 years ago. Because we keep reading, and there have been several in Texas lately, we keep reading announcements from the SEC about Ponzi schemes being set up in the state of Texas. One of them was just closed down on a real estate, theoretically a non-traded real estate fund that had been running for 13 years. So people were getting money back we mentioned this last week, at a rate of 10% a year.
9.6%.
They were getting right around 10% a year back on their investment for over a decade. And it was a Ponzi scheme. It was a scam. But the point is, all these people who were getting the money back were telling all their friends about it who got in on it. And these things generally don't really show up You don't realize they're there. The federal regulators don't realize they're there until the fund runs out of money and can't pay people, and people start complaining. And that by that time, they're out of money. It's time for clawback. But it, presuming that we have a downturn in the next couple of years, which is incidentally what the bond market is warning us about right now, there's a sag in the bond yield curve between 2 and 5 years, that there's going to be some kind of at least slowdown and possibly a recession. This is when these things come to light, because people suddenly need money. They start asking for their money back, and the system runs out of money. And that's why Stanford showed up in 2009, I think it was 2008, that Madoff was uncovered. And the reason was very, very simple. We got a downturn in the market. We got a downturn in the economy. People needed their money, so they were asking for their money back. He emptied out his Ponzi scheme pool and couldn't afford to pay any more money to people because there was no money left. And that's when these things appear. And I'll just warn you, if anywhere you're getting some high interest rate
that's somehow guaranteed or has been so consistent that it doesn't make sense, it probably doesn't make sense.
Even if it, so there's two kinds of scams going on out there right now. One of them is the illegal Ponzi scheme, and the other one is the high yield leveraged bond interest rates. And just be very cautious about both of those. And when they collapse, I suspect it's going to have an effect on bond funds, and particularly it's going to try and test the bond ETFs. The ETFs in bonds, or the what's it's not ETF, there's another ET something or another, electronically traded, it's not fund, but there's a series of new financial instruments out there that have a tendency, they really haven't been tested. And we could see an implosion of those newly traded instruments, new instruments, just like I'm going on and on here.
It's good but, things
okay,
to go on
but
and on.
There's though. One other issue out there, and that is the alternative funds, the alt funds. There was a fund that was in the business of converting, was reported in the Wall Street Journal, was in the business of converting from an open-ended regular mutual fund to a closed-ended fund, because they didn't like the cash flow stresses it was putting on them. It turned out that they had 15% of their fund invested in an illiquid investment, a non-traded stock. And their accounting firm, we had one of the big accounting firms doing it, and they said, hey, this is actually only worth half of what you're carrying it for on the books. So they filed the accounting firm and hired a new one. That kind of thing is going on more and more than we like to even think about.
And this is something, when we talk about the problems with the trade war, this is one of the major implications, is that if you're in some type of an alternative investment, and if you dig into it and you find that you have timberland, that's one of the most common alternative investment vehicles out there, is that it's property with trees growing on it that should be harvested every 20 to 50 years to bring the lumber off the timberland. The thing is, these alternative investments, these pooled assets, have purchased up huge swaths of land that don't sell or buy very often. How many times does 1 million acres of pine forest get sold? And it's very, very rarely. It's less than 5 per decade, which makes it really hard to price those things. So they leave it at the purchase price, or they give you an appreciation value based on what they think the timber is going to be worth at some point, and you get dividend payouts on it. It seems really nice, except that we just had, as one of the very first opening salvos in the trade war, was a tariff on softwood lumber from Canada, which caused the prices of lumber to go through the roof. And you'd think, well, that's great for my investment if I've got this alternative, except that all of the alternatives did the same thing at the same time and started harvesting. And then the price of lumber dropped through the floor, because if it was a lumber floor, it may have broken the lumber on the way through. The idea here is that the housing market started slowing down at the same time that all this harvesting of timber was going on. So when the lumber actually hit the market to be purchased by the big box stores and by the manufacturers of these homes, the demand for that lumber was much lower. So when it hit the market, they didn't get what they expected to get for the lumber. That's an important piece, is that if you have a very long-term intended to be stable position that has short-term implications from the trade war, it becomes a lot more dangerous, a lot less stable. The whole idea behind these alternative investments was to give they call it a negative correlation against the other assets. They have not been negatively correlated. They have not been going in the opposite direction of the rest of the market. They've been stuck with the rest of the market in the middle of all of this. So understand what you own, preferably before you own it.
When you have a non-traditional investment, whatever it may be, other than plain vanilla open-ended mutual fund that has been around a long time and has stable management and is well managed and a lot of people own it. I mean, that sounds very boring. But let me give you if you have something else in your portfolio that gives it more sizzle and more spice and more excitement, like non-traded real estate investment trusts or whatever you've got, there is a very high risk to that. Let me give you an example. We railed against Bitcoin. We're talking about another 10-year. It was 10 years ago that Bitcoin came into existence, by the way, this year.
And November of 2017 was the peak.
And it was like, and do you remember what the peak was?
Right up close to $20,000 of Bitcoin. What was it? $18,900, something like that?
Yeah, it was $19,650 per Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Do you know what it's trading at now?
I'm going to say a range between $2,800 and $3,500.
You're right. It's around $3,500. So basically, if you bought in at $20,000 of Bitcoin and it's worth $3,500 now, how much have you lost?
It depends on if you sold, but if you stay in it long enough, you're liable to lose it all, because the long term of the Bitcoin. Let me throw in a piece on that subject here real quick. Last week, a Canadian coin exchange CEO died of complications of Crohn's disease in India. That's one.
Oh yeah, I remember reading about that.
This is one part of the story. That's tough. The Crohn's disease kills people. The other part is that he died as the only person that knew the password to $130 million worth of Bitcoin in today's prices. So multiply that by the difference between $3,500 and $20,000 and think of what it was worth in November of 2017.
And the worst part about it wasn't his Bitcoin. He was serving as a retention for other people's Bitcoin.
He's the CEO of this supposedly safe company that's holding the Bitcoins for people so they don't lose them. Here's the thing. They've hired firms to come in and try to crack the encryption on the computer so that they can get to the keys for the Bitcoins and give the investors their Bitcoins back. And Bitcoins it wasn't the only type of cryptocurrency in there. There was Ethereum and there was a whole series of others. Here's the problem with that, and this is why I say Bitcoins have a limited life expectancy, period. Any cryptocurrency has a limited life expectancy. If the firm can crack the encryption on the computer to get the keys, which so far they have not been able to, then they can crack the blockchain and change who owns the cryptocurrency. The value of the cryptocurrency, this is where the word crypto comes in, is the cryptography underneath it or on top of it. It's not really three-dimensional. I like to envision it that way. It's based on encrypting a block in a ledger, a group of transactions. You've encrypted it, and that's where the value of this cryptocurrency comes from. If you can crack the encryption, the cryptocurrency becomes worthless. Which means when quantum computing becomes mainstream, cryptocurrencies will become worthless. The whole concept of a cryptocurrency was based on a limited supply, except how many different types of crypto coins are out there now? There are hundreds of them. There is no limitation on supply. My great aunt could make a new cryptocurrency if she wanted to. Anybody can make a cryptocurrency. And the initial coin offerings have been hammered by the SEC repeatedly. If you're treating it at all like a security instead of a commodity, then this SEC is going to rip you up because there are rules for that stuff. It's to protect people that are buying. And so wrapping that all up, we were railing against cryptocurrencies in the middle of the boom time when everybody thought cryptocurrency was the wave of the future and that everybody was going to buy pizzas with their $20,000 Bitcoin. And I'm going, that's a lot of pizza. How do you get change for that?
and another factor about the Bitcoin and about the alternative investments is there's no regulated exchange for them. You really don't know what they're worth.
There are regulated exchanges for them, but there aren't many.
For the Bitcoin regulated exchanges?
Yeah, the SEC has gotten involved here. There's a coin, I'm not going to say the name without knowing it for sure, but either CoinBank or CoinDesk, please do your research, is a regulated exchange. They are working to maintain records on who owns what, which is kind of the opposite of what the whole intent behind a cryptocurrency is. It was supposed to be anonymous without government intervention, but in order for it to be safe for people to own without it being stolen, people have to have records of who owns it.
But my point is that again and again and again, the exchange, there's some exchanges, one up in Toronto that supposedly was regulated by the
Canadians,
but it's not regulated in the same way the stock exchange is regulated.
Correct.
And the end result was that somebody hacked it and basically took all, if you had your coins on deposit there, they're gone.
Yeah.
And there is no SIPC absolutely. Or FDIC or any federal
Nothing.
Agency that backs those coins if they suddenly are gone. And the risk in any alternative currency is huge. The more stable something is that appears to be growing, the more stable it appears to be, the more risk there is in it, and we need to do some commercials.
Yeah, we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is February 16th, 2019, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call and ask us questions or make comments at 254-773-1400. Do we have a caller already?
I believe so. We have a caller on 773-1400. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
A moment ago, you mentioned the insurance industry, and I have a question for you.
Okay.
Does Lloyd's of London still play, or does it now play an important role in our economy? That's all.
Yeah, it's a good question. Very good question.
Yes.
Yes, it does still play an important role in our economy, very much so. It is there's a network of insurance providers that Lloyd still is the head of. And do you mind if I tell a little history here?
Certainly welcome to.
Lloyd's of London was originally a coffee shop. Oh, wow. How did that happen? Well, Lloyd had a coffee shop in London on the Thames River, not far from where ship owners and ship captains would meet regularly. So they decided with the advent of good coffee from the Indies to come and have coffee at Lloyd's, and they would sit at the same tables, and they started pooling assets to protect each other in the event of piracy or the event of a big gale and one of them losing a ship, because if your fleet is of one ship, it's really helpful if you're with other people and you can pool money just in case somebody loses a ship out there. So Lloyd started holding the assets for all these ship owners and captains until eventually he said, all right, I'm going to take a little cut off of this and let's make this a bigger pool. Let's make it a larger group of people than one table full of ship owners. Let's make it a lot of ship owners putting their money in here. And the whole idea is not very many ships sink. And if a lot of ships sink, then it's going to hit this pool really hard. It's kind of the advent of modern insurance. And Lloyd still takes that approach of heading up a consortium of companies to say, let's pool our assets to cover higher risk areas or lower risk areas. They're also one of the first to say, no, that's a really high risk area. We're not going to touch insuring that.
The Lloyd still works off of the concept of underwriters, and underwriters meaning very wealthy people who have millions of dollars that they invest in Lloyd's, and they underwrite a risk. And the people who at Lloyd's act as brokers between the wealthy companies and wealthy individuals who put the money in there to underwrite a risk, they commonly are very low-key and hidden in the background as a secondary form of insurance for major organizations. We have a caller again on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, guys, great show as usual. I'll catch you all the time that I can. Just out of curiosity, let's say in 2017 you had, for round figures, a $10,000 loss in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Then the 2018, you had a $10,000 gain. Now, that would offset with no capital gains tax, correct?
Well, if you structured it correctly.
It depends on how long you held the assets that gave you a loss and how long you held the assets that gave you a gain.
So there are circumstances where they could offset each other, yes. But there are also, you can screw that one up pretty easily, too.
Long-term capital gains are something you've held for longer than 12 months. Those are used only to offset long-term capital losses and vice versa. So if you have a capital loss that's 12 months old or longer, then you can use those within limitations. This is where the tax code gets really convoluted and silly. You can use those to offset long-term capital gains.
And you can carry them forward if you have nothing to offset the losses, and you can carry those losses forward. So that's what you're asking. And then, given all those circumstances, the answer would be yes.
If you registered it and carried it forward in 2017, you should be able to use it in 2018, but consult a CPA.
Okay. Also, now, if you did not sell any stock during 2018, so you had no capital gains, but say you had $10,000 in dividends, now, could the loss be applied against the dividend, $10,000 dividend income, and not pay taxes on that?
There again, now we're going to get to where we can't answer that question, because there are different. There's qualifying dividends, there's non-qualifying dividends, and some of the dividends you get, people are saying, I wanted high dividend. In fact, they were getting capital gains distributions and thought they were dividends. So
this is CPA country, yeah. And this is why they get paid what they get paid, yeah. And why the new tax law has given them job security for as long as it's the tax code.
Yeah, they're going to rename that tax law that we went under last year. Did you hear that? It's called the CPA Full Employment Act of 2017.
Because if you're a business owner and you don't have a CPA, then you're going to get one now.
Right. All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right. You're welcome.
Enjoy your show every weekend.
Well, appreciate the call.
And here's to more capital gains.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
and less capital losses.
There was an interesting point that happened this week that I think is important. And this is Jeff. I think, because I'm a geek and I think some things are important and odd and fascinating.
Usually we agree on that because we're both geeks. So
the bond market, after Thursday's reports of a drop in retail sales and a drop in manufacturing and basically a lot of bad news, and interestingly enough, the fact that good news, bad news, the fact that Germany had one quarter, it was down 0.2%, the GDP was, and the next quarter, the fourth quarter of last year, it was 0%.
Zero. So it didn't. Go into an official recession, but it was so close.
But it could, because that was just the first estimate that came out, and they could come back and revise it down 0.1%, and then Germany would officially be in a recession.
And Japan's right in the same kind of economic boat.
This is the interesting thing. The stock market basically ignored that. It was down a little bit on Thursday, but it came back on Friday. The bond market went, the yield on the Treasury went down and stayed down. The Treasury was saying, oh, we might be headed for some rough times. The bond market was saying that, where the stock market was saying, no way, Jose, it's all rosy down the road. As a matter of fact, technically, I haven't looked at the exact curves and figures and everything else. Technically, we could be out of the correction. On Friday's close on the stock market could have officially put us out of the correction period. We'll have to wait and see. But there's an important thing to note here. I believe, this is Jeff again speaking, it's just my belief, and there's certainly no guarantees that my guesses are correct on this. It all hinges on the trade war with China. If the president says, all is good, we're dropping the tariffs, you could see this expansion in this bull market get a new lease on life and take another leg up and do wonderfully this year, despite the fact that the economy is definitely slowing down. If the president decides to go all in like he has on the wall, if he goes all in on the trade war and really starts trying to beat up on China, definitely want to have your seatbelt fastened and you want to have your powder dry, but don't bail out of the market because this is a temporary external event. And temporary external events go away within a year or two.
Yeah, so that's an important factor. When we say keep your powder dry, we've mentioned this sporadically throughout this. This is a fundamental issue. Make sure that you have cash in the bank. When I ask people that have been in the market for many years what they have in savings, quite often they start talking to me about what they have in their 401k or what they have in a mutual fund. And what I'm talking about in savings means safe, means stuck somewhere with FDIC insurance on it, or SIPC in cash. Because if you don't have the means to get through an emergency without touching your investments, you could hurt yourself if the market's when the market goes down. Because the market goes down, just look at history. We've got lots of downturns in the market. You don't want to be reaching for your emergency money when the market's down. And we've got another caller on 773-1400. We only just have a few minutes, so make it quick. Caller?
Hello, caller on 773-1400. Go ahead.
Nothing.
Okay.
Hung up.
Apparently it was the wrong number. Anyway, we're at a teetering point. We could go either way. Don't try to time the market. And why do I say don't try to time the market? Very simply, no one has ever been successful at it, including some people that are a lot smarter than we are and you are.
Sir Isaac Newton should have won the Nobel Prize in physics, economics, medicine, chemistry, and he still got bamboozled by market timing.
Yeah, he lost his fortune through market timing.
So, and he's one of my heroes in history. He's right up there with Da Vinci as someone that has pushed forward human intellect and civilization in a huge bound. And he was not able to time the market. He did it correctly.
He got out when
he said this is unsustainable. This is too expensive. There's no reason why the South Seas company should be this expensive, and then he sold out of it, and then for 3 years it continued to go up, and he got in right before the collapse again. So
he said, I can understand the movements of the stars and the suns, I can understand the movements of the planets, and I can plot everything that there is to do with physics, but the movements of the market are beyond my understanding.
Yeah, and so making sure that you understand its psychology. Understand that you need to be able to get through downturns and be diversified. Don't put all your fortune in one thing. And we're about out of time. If you'd like to contact us off the air, there's a local number available.
254-947-1111.
Or 1-800-914-PLAN. That's 800-914-7526. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, read our newsletter. Listen to recordings of the radio program going back multiple years, and read our philosophy. Until next week, we've really enjoyed this, and thanks for listening. So this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.